Palestinians hold a funeral for three young men killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Iran dismisses allegations by the group of seven wealthy nations over its peaceful nuclear program, calling them unfounded. And the U.S. signs a pact that gives it access to Papua New Guinea's airfields and ports, as America competes with China's growing footprints in the Pacific region.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mews. Thanks for joining us.
Palestinians hold a funeral procession for three men Israeli forces shot dead in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. The young Palestinians were shot during a raid on Balata camp east of Nablus. Public mourning has been declared in the city for the three men. Israeli forces also injured at least 65 Palestinians, three of them critically. Hamas resistance movement now says Israeli crimes will not affect Palestinians' will to fight the regime and to support the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The movement says Palestinians' sanctities are red lines that Israel should not cross. The regime has stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians since the formation of a new far-right cabinet under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu late last year. This year alone, Israeli forces have killed over 140 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Earlier, we talked to Mona Kandil to get more details on the deadly Israeli raid. Here's what she had to say.
The raid this morning, or even before dawn, to Balata refugee camp in Nablus was described as one of the largest operations in years. Clashes took place between the Palestinian fighters and the residents of the refugee camp of Balata and Israeli forces, who blockaded all the entrances after or during the incursion to Balata refugee camp. A number of Palestinians had been wounded as well, according to Palestinian paramedics, including some were shot by live fire, others suffocated due to inhaling tear gas. Some were shot even by rubber-coated bullets, according to the Palestinian paramedics. This incursion to Balata refugee camp came at the same time when the Israeli forces raided the eastern area of Nablus.
Barrage of condemnations is coming in after a far-right Israeli minister visited the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in a violation of the holy site status quo. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman denounced the move, calling it a provocative step by an extremist member of the Israeli apartheid regime. Nasser Kanani called for urgent measures by the international community to prevent such crimes. Earlier, the Arab League slammed the move as a dangerous escalation, warning of an uncontrollable religious conflict. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas also described the raid as barbaric. The U.S. also weighed in. Washington called the visit provocative, saying the holy site should not be used for political purposes. The Sunday visit by the cabinet minister Itamar Ben-Gvir was his second since he took office. He also claimed Israel owns the compound. Palestinians pushed back against the comments, saying such rhetoric does not change the status quo of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has conducted a military drill in southern Lebanon. As our correspondent Mariam Saleh reports, the drill simulated an operation repelling an Israeli invasion of Lebanon back in the year 2000.
To commemorate the 23rd anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from Israeli occupation, Hezbollah conducted an unprecedented live military drill in the South Lebanese town of Aramta. After a show of hand-to-hand combat and a parade of all-terrain vehicles and motorcycles, the fighters launched a simulation of taking over an Israeli post in the occupied Galilee area. Over 100 media outlets covered the event, which many say is something unseen since before the liberation in 2000.
The location chosen for this is quite telling. First of all, it's close to the border with Israel. And, of course, this area back in before 2000 was under Israeli occupation. The old Bir Kalab outpost the Israelis had was just up on the hill behind us. So this is very familiar territory for Hezbollah.
The head of Hezbollah's executive council, Sayed Hashem Safieddine, warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that his cabinet will not be able to change the rules of engagement. Observers see that Hezbollah is primarily seeking psychological warfare against Israel with this maneuver.
But clearly the message is towards the Israelis primarily. As we've seen with the recent escalation in Gaza, we've seen a tightening of the ties, the military ties between Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and so on. So I think this show today feeds into that.
Hezbollah says the drill sent a message to the Israeli regime about the readiness of the resistance to deter enemy aggression and defend Lebanon. Israeli forces left most of southern Lebanon on May 25, 2000, after 22 years of occupation. Hezbollah's military drill is not merely a show of force, with prospects of a possible confrontation and continuous Israeli aggressions towards Al-Quds. Hezbollah wants to send a clear message to the Israelis that its deterrence capabilities remain intact. Mariam Saleh, South Lebanon.
Iran has slammed a statement by the Group of Seven countries after it accused Tehran of escalating its nuclear program. Iran's foreign ministry rejected the allegation as baseless. Spokesman Nasser Kanani said Iran's nuclear program has been peaceful and that nuclear weapons have no place in the security doctrine. Kanani also slammed the G7 for its paradoxical policies towards other countries. It was a reference to the G7's call for abidance by a UN resolution the U.S. is breaching by imposing anti-Iran sanctions. The spokesman also slammed the group for accusing Iran of destabilizing West Asia. He said G7 members are the main source of regional destabilization. Kanani also once again rejected providing drones to Russia for its war in Ukraine. He reiterated the need for a political solution there. The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has appointed Brigadier General Ali Akbar Ahmadiyan as the new Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council. Ahmadiyan, 62, has been the head of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Strategic Center. He's also served as the commander of the forces' navy and is now a member of the Expediency Council. He's replacing Ali Shamkhani, who served in the powerful security position for 10 years. The Iranian Navy's 86th Fleet has returned home following an 8-month voyage around the globe. Addressing a ceremony to welcome the arrival of the naval fleet, top Iranian General Mohammad Baghdadi called the expedition a landmark accomplishment in the history of the country's naval missions.
Mission accomplished. Iranian Navy's 86th Flotilla has wrapped up its 8-month voyage and returned home. The flotilla, comprised of domestically manufactured Dena destroyer and Macron forward base ship, arrived at the southern port city of Bandar Abbas on Saturday. The naval fleet set sail on a mission around the world from Bandar Abbas in September 2022. The flotilla stopped at the port of Mumbai, India, and then docked in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, after passing through the Bay of Bengal and the Strait of Malacca. The fleet continued its journey towards Java Sea and passed through the Strait of Makassar, arriving in the vast Pacific Ocean for the first time in the history of Iran's military seafaring. Crossing the Pacific Ocean, the fleet moved toward the Strait of Magellan in the south of the Americas and entered the South Atlantic Ocean. The naval squadron also passed the coasts of Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, and finally anchoring in the port of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. The flotilla then crossed the Atlantic Ocean and anchored in the city of Cape Town, South Africa. It then berthed in the coasts of Oman and finally sailed into the Iranian territorial waters. An official ceremony was held in Bandar Abbas to welcome the arrival of the naval fleet. Addressing the official homecoming ceremony of the flotilla, the chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces said the arrival of the 86th Naval Flotilla is a source of pride for the Iranian nation and a landmark accomplishment in the history of the country's naval missions. Major General Mohammad Hossein Baghdadi said the flotilla concluded its historic voyage on the high seas to mark what he called an outstanding achievement despite Western-led sanctions against the Islamic Republic. General Baghdadi said maritime prowess is among the most important factors of Iran's military might. He added, "We do not lack anything to achieve such an ideal and are gifted with homegrown industries for that purpose." He noted that the Iranian courageous commanders and marines undertake naval missions valiantly and fearlessly.
The arrival of the Iranian Navy's 86th Fleet shines the spotlight on the maritime prowess of the Islamic Republic. The Navy has been maintaining regional and international peace and enhancing international economic stability by protecting shipping routes. Iran is also determined to boost its defense capabilities in the face of threats.
The arrival of the naval fleet to Bandar Abbas comes as the unprecedented move of the Iranian Navy in carrying out such difficult missions ushers in a new era for the Iranian armed forces. As Major General Bagheri put it, the 86th Flotilla of the Navy fulfilled a historic mission. Even major countries in the world do not have the courage to undertake such a task. What makes the round-the-world mission significant, though, is the way Western countries, namely the United States, reacted to it. In February, the U.S. Treasury sanctioned the two ships while they were on the international voyage. According to Iranian officials, the U.S. has also failed to prevent the Iranian naval flotilla from sailing through the Panama Canal, an 82-kilometer waterway in Panama that connects the Atlantic Pacific Oceans. Iran's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, has said, quote, "The global arrogance tried to block the Iranian flotilla's mission through threats and sanctions, but the successful voyage marked another slap in their faces." The Navy commander also said that France claimed that the Iranian ships had entered its waters, but they changed course when they were reminded of their own shipping rules and regulations. All those reactions highlight Iran's naval prowess in international waters. In recent years, naval forces of the Islamic Republic have enhanced their presence throughout global waters to protect shipping routes and provide security for merchant vessels and tankers. The Iranian Navy has also regularly carried out patrols in the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean to fight piracy in an effort to secure vessels commuting in international waters, not to mention that numerous attacks on Iranian or foreign vessels have been thwarted by the Iranian Navy in recent years. All in all, the unprecedented voyage by the 86th Flotilla not only has shown Iran's maritime capabilities, but drove home the point that the language of threat and force does not work with Iran, as it is committed to asserting its strength in international waters and providing security to its vessels.
The U.S. has signed a security agreement with Papua New Guinea as rivalry between Washington and Beijing is growing in the Pacific region. Under the deal, American forces are given access to Papua New Guinea's airfields and ports. In return, the island nation will gain access to the U.S. satellite surveillance. The U.S. State Department says the pact will enhance bilateral cooperation and will increase stability in the Pacific. The deal has sparked several protests in the island country over the impact on ties with key trade partner China. The U.S. has been expanding its presence in the Pacific as part of its strategic shift to East Asia, where it seeks to contain the growing power of China. Beijing also signed a security pact with the Solomon Islands in 2022. Russia has renewed its warning to the West about supplying F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine. Moscow says providing Kiev with the warplanes would bring up the question of NATO's involvement in the ongoing conflict. The Russian ambassador to Washington sounded the alarm that advanced American fighter jets may end up bombing targets belonging to Russia. Anatoly Antonov pointed to Russian-controlled Crimea, where Kiev has stepped up its attacks. Antonov said any Ukrainian strike on Crimea would be regarded as a strike on Russia. On Saturday, Moscow cautioned that Western countries would suffer colossal risks if they offer the warplanes to Ukraine. That after the U.S. gave a green light to its allies to supply Kiev with fighter jets, and allow training programs for Ukrainian pilots. Washington had for months expressed its reluctance to send warplanes to Kiev, citing numerous reasons. Independent Russian journalist Dmitry Zolotarev joined us earlier for comments. He said the West military support for Ukraine, especially regarding the F-16 jets, is not a game changer.
The amount of, tanks in the time being, and the amount of the F-16s they are talking in question is not going to be too many. And anything they send into Ukraine, it's not a game changer. Well, prolonging, but not for too long. And the question is, will they do it? And they are reluctant because they never know what Russia's answer is going to be. Russia, it's not the first time when Russia says, it will arise the question of NATO's involvement in the war. It's not the first time. And they are acting like, well, okay, what are you going to do? So what? We sent tanks, and what have you done? Nothing. Russia, Russia has never taken a stupid step. And don't expect Russia to do it now or to start. Russia will do, will take everything very considerate. And, I don't know what Russia's response is going to be. Should they send F-16s? But we'll see. One thing I can say that F-16s are quite old aircraft. They are not modern, and they don't stand too many chances against Russian air force and anti-aircraft force.
The U.S. refugee policy goes under the spotlight again in the European Parliament, branded as illegal under international law and discriminatory. Refugees in Belgium claim those seeking asylum from Ukraine are receiving preferential treatment. From Brussels, Jerome Hughes reports.
Just a couple of weeks ago, there were hundreds of refugees, mainly from African and Middle Eastern countries, sleeping on the streets outside the main asylum application centre in Brussels. Authorities have since cleared the area. The refugees have fled to neighbouring countries or have been crammed into emergency accommodation. A few remain in the area, but say their situation would be different if they came from Ukraine. A debate in the European Parliament has heard that EU nations are erecting borders on land and strengthening aggressive coast guard services at sea. The bloc pays billions of euro to outside countries to stop refugees from attempting to travel here, unless they are from Ukraine.
The EU slogan is, break the business model of smugglers. But what we do is feeding them by blocking all pathways to protection.
There is a heavy far-right anti-refugee presence in the Parliament.
Europe needs a policy based on strong border control.
But many legislators are calling for a more civilized approach.
We already fund third countries like Libya, actually militias over there, to build camps, to host people there. And we see murder, we see rape, and we do not see a humane solution.
Key EU figures are currently in Hiroshima, Japan, for a G7 meeting. 350,000 people were living there when their closest ally, the United States, dropped its catastrophic atomic bomb in 1945. More support for Ukraine is high on the agenda. Critics say the last thing on their minds is providing refuge to those fleeing countries they helped destabilize in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18th, 2023.
Today's student is someone who will be active in the fields of culture and the media tomorrow. Today's student is tomorrow's leader, mastermind, and an influential element. People don't stay young and aren't students forever. Today, you can prepare the ground in such a way that when tomorrow comes and you become one of the elements that I mentioned, you will be able to have an impact in the true sense of the world. You can change both the thinking and the reality of your society. Today, everyone is saying this. I have said it, and others are saying it too. The world is undergoing a transformation. Who is creating this transformation? Masterminds, people who are active in different fields, and those who are involved in big projects are the ones who are creating this transformation. You are among them. You are students today.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Tomorrow you will be the ones who can bring about changes. Thus, I expect you to look to the future in this manner. Of course, the person who can make a change tomorrow is not necessarily a pious, outstanding, faithful believer. Sometimes some people deviate. You should try to avoid deviation. You need to try and move on the straight path of God. You are moving toward that kind of a tomorrow. Strengthen your foundations, your intellectual foundation, your foundation in faith, your foundation in being rational, from today, so that you can be ready for that kind of tomorrow. It seems to me that there are four points here: religion, wisdom, science, and determination. These four things are necessary. Religious foundations, scientific foundations, intellectual foundations, and foundations in determination, unwavering determination, unwavering resoluteness. You need to strengthen these in yourselves. Whoever is able to work on self-improvement more in these areas will be more influential in the future. Some will reach the peak. Some may not reach the top, but they will make an impact to some degree. It all depends on how much you have prepared yourselves. This is another point.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Syrian President Bashar al-Assad at the Arab League summit, his one-time enemy Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman, seen here greeting him. A symbolic moment, sealing Assad's reintegration into the Arab fold after being suspended from the League and isolated by most of the region for over a decade. A man who wanted him dethroned, who supported terrorist groups with the sole aim of toppling him. But now, that is wonder under the bridge. Assad lining up for the League's family photograph. Every handshake, confirmation of his reintegration. One after the other, Arab leaders welcoming Syria's reintegration, and during his own address, Assad repeatedly said that Syria belonged to the Arab world. There have been words of condemnation against Saudi Arabia and the Arab League normalizing ties, rhetoric from the losing end of the so-called Syrian opposition, something that should be shelved in the archives. For there is a new reality taking shape in West Asia. The Arab League Secretary General made sure to relay that message. Saudi Arabia is now a firm believer that security cannot be bought and that countries in this region can establish their own security. The Saudi Foreign Minister, Prince Faisal bin Farham, called for cooperation between Arab countries to achieve security, stability, and economic prosperity. West Asian security, however, does not serve the interests of the U.S. All of these reconciliations with Syria is shunned and rejected by the U.S. The decision to readmit Syria to the Arab League represents a rejection of U.S. interests. The Arab rush to welcome Damascus back into the fold has happened despite public objections from the U.S. U.S. efforts at easing Mr. Assad out and replacing him with an inclusive, democratic government have gone nowhere, leaving American officials on the sidelines. That is one view. However, additionally, U.S. lawmakers are proposing a bill that would prohibit Washington from either recognizing or normalizing relations with any Syrian government led by Assad. The legislation is also a warning to Turkey and Arab countries that if they engage with Assad's government, they could face severe consequences. But who's listening? Challenges do remain. Arab countries are keen to invest in Syria, especially in its reconstruction. But the U.S. legislation built upon the CSAR Syria Civilian Protection Act, a 2019 law that authorized sanctions on those who do business with the Syrian government. Then there's the issue of Israel, who has continued bombing Syria. How will Arab countries deal with Israel when it comes to Syria? Israel is one of the sorest losers in this, since now there's a stronger united front in the form of an axis of resistance against Israel. On the one hand, the U.S., who is occupying Syrian soil and stealing and selling its oil, is an outsider, accompanied by the Israeli regime, which has no cards left to unify Arab countries against Iran. Nevertheless, China's view on the diminished U.S. role in the region, which closely mirrors Iran's stance, has said it best. Syria's Arab League reintegration, proof that when the U.S. shadow shrinks, peace spreads.
On September 9, 2001, a series of terror attacks targeted the United States. On that morning, a group of terrorists hijacked four commercial airliners. The hijackers crashed the first two planes into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in New York City. The third plane succeeded in crashing into the Pentagon, but the fourth one crashed in rural Pennsylvania. The U.S. regime used the incident to launch what it called the Global War on Terror.
They are obsessed with fueling conflict because they profit by the bloodshed, by the turmoil, by the tension, by the diplomatic unease. A lot of money is transferred into the bureaucracies of the military, the intelligence community, the diplomatic community, the military-industrial complex, the war profiteers who make bullets, bombs, tanks, helicopters, guns.
Washington first invaded Afghanistan and then attacked Iraq. A number of other countries were also affected by the wars.
Hundreds of thousands of civilians were killed. 7,000 by the U.S. in the first month of the war, but now hundreds of thousands of civilians were killed by all parties over the 20 years, and that's in part because Iraq descended into civil war shortly after the U.S. invasion. And then in addition, many millions of people were displaced. Millions of people are still displaced internally and also as refugees in the region.
The military aggressions were devastating for the affected countries and killed countless people. A new research by Brown University's Cost of War project has now shed light on the human cost of U.S. wars in the region. The report says America's war on terror in war zones of Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen killed at least 4.5 to 4.6 million people, though the precise mortality figure remains unknown. The study reviews a wide range of factors contributing to mortality. Those include economic collapse and the resulting loss of livelihood for local residents, the destruction of health infrastructure and public services, environmental contamination, as well as other cultural effects of war that can lead to further violence down the line. Some of these people were killed in the fighting, but far more, especially children, have been killed by the reverberating effects of war, such as spread of disease. The report says these latter indirect deaths are estimated to be around 3.7 million. It says these deaths and related health problems have resulted from the destruction of economies, public services, and the environment in the affected countries. The report has also highlighted the fact that indirect deaths grow in scale over time. The researchers found staggering levels of child malnutrition in some of the affected countries, with Afghanistan and Yemen topping the list. In the wake of Washington's two-decade military occupation, more than 3 million Afghan children are now experiencing wasting, a symptom of severe and potentially life-threatening malnutrition. The U.S. officially ended its war in Afghanistan, but today Afghans are suffering and dying from war-related causes at higher rates than ever. Afghanistan's economy has collapsed, and over half of the population now lives in extreme poverty on less than $1.90 per day. More than 7.6 million children under 5 are suffering from acute malnutrition or wasting in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Somalia. wasting means simply not getting enough food, literally wasting to skin and bones, putting these children at greater risk of death. Diseases such as measles and cholera often sicken malnourished people, particularly children, and at the same time worsen malnutrition.
And then what we also see is that even in the places where the fighting has stopped, civilians and other people, like healthcare workers, have been injured by unexploded ordnance, which has been left in the wake of the war. So the story continues. It's not over. It wasn't quick. It wasn't easy. And it certainly wasn't cost-free.
Hunger crises are precipitated by war's destruction of economies and the impoverishment of millions in the war zones. Poverty lessens people's abilities to grow and buy food, stay in their home communities, access clean water and sanitation, pay for healthcare and medicine, keep children away from hazardous jobs and other essential pathways to preserving health and life. Explosive remnants of war, including unexploded mines, render land inaccessible to farm and block the transport of goods. Generally, populations displaced by violence face some of the worst levels of food insecurity and malnutrition.
Iran and Russia have signed an agreement on the construction of the Rasht Astar Railway, a strategic transport corridor that connects the existing railways of the two countries and Azerbaijan. The Iranian transport minister and his Russian counterpart, Vitaly Savelyev, put their signatures on the deal worth $1.6 billion during a ceremony in Tehran on Wednesday. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and his Russian counterpart oversaw the event in person and via video link. The 162-kilometer railway will connect the Iranian city of Rasht near the Caspian Sea to Astara on the border with Azerbaijan. Upon completion, the railway would serve as a shorter and cheaper transit pathway for Asia and Europe's businesses. The development would also turn Iran into the region's trade crossroads and bring along stable and profuse revenues with the Islamic Republic. Including the part that crosses Iran, the passage serves to link Europe to the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean's littoral states, as well as the southeastern Asian countries. Transporting goods through the pathway takes 21 days. The alternative maritime route that travels across Europe's western and then southern flank before heading into the Red Sea, however, takes 45 days to complete and features an additional 30% expense.
This is a very important agreement that allows us to move to a new stage in the development of cooperation in the transport field. This is the largest infrastructure project that concerns the construction of a 162-kilometer section of the railway between the Iranian city of Astara and the city of Rasht. This is the section that is enough to completely close the railway communication through the territory of Russia, Azerbaijan, Iran, from St. Petersburg to the Persian Gulf and to Bandar Abbas. As soon as this project is implemented, then accordingly we will have a route and the possibility of deliveries both in transit to Europe and deliveries from Russia to the Persian Gulf. This is a huge market.
Separately, Iran and Russia are expanding their cooperation in the banking sector. Russia's second largest bank, VTB, has opened a branch in Iran. VTB is the first ever Russian bank to offer services in the Islamic Republic. Last December, VTB launched a service allowing both individuals and businesses to transfer money to and from Iran. Iranian companies will now have the chance to make international bank transfers. Moreover, VTB Bank and its subsidiaries are extensively active in South American countries, empowering Iran to diversify its exchange routes with export target countries in that region. Earlier this year, Governor of the Central Bank of Iran, Mohammad Reza Farzin, said a direct link had been established between the central banks of Iran and Russia. Iran and Russia have signed scores of economic and energy deals as the two countries seek to replicate their successful security and military cooperation in efforts that could offset the impacts of Western sanctions on their economies. Russia's Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak led a high-ranking delegation to major events and ceremonies. Novak met Iranian Oil Minister Javad Oji and also visited a number of oil and gas equipment manufacturers,
and discuss prospects for working together in the fuel and energy sectors. He said the oil and gas industry is a backbone for the economies of our countries. Strengthening bilateral cooperation in this area will undoubtedly increase the economic sustainability of Russia and Iran.
We are developing 8 of our oil and gas fields with strong Russian companies, and we have agreed with Mr. Novak for the development of 6 more fields.
The two sides also discussed cooperation in the field of electrical and nuclear energy, as well as renewable energy sources. Russia and Iran, both under Western sanctions, are forging closer ties in order to support their economies and to undermine Western sanctions, which they both cast as unjustified. Tehran and Moscow have embarked on deepening cooperation amid massive Western sanctions.
We are seeking specifically joint investments, facilitation of customs services and banking issues regarding the transfer of money between state banks and Mir Business Bank in Russia, which is of great help for Iranian businessmen.
Iran and Russia have signed major deals in recent months to boost economic, trade, energy and military cooperation. Russia is also delivering a complete squadron of Sukhoi Su-35 fighter jets to the Islamic Republic of Iran, development that will likely further rile up the West as Tehran and Moscow deepen their defense and economic cooperation in defiance of sweeping sanctions and coercive measures.
Turkey's presidential election is headed for a runoff vote. That's according to official results from the country's Supreme Election Council. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan took 49.5% of Sunday's vote, with his main challenger Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu getting 44.89%. More than 64 million Turkish people, including overseas voters, were eligible to vote, and nearly 89% participated in the election to choose their next president and parliament for a 5-year term. As neither secured more than 50% of the vote, they will face off in a second round on May 28th. This is only the third time that Turks directly voted for a president, with Erdogan winning both previous elections outright in the first round. Polls and observers had predicted an advantage, if not an outright victory, for 74-year-old Kılıçdaroğlu. But as the final results from Sunday's election were announced, it became clear 69-year-old Erdogan had defied expectations, seizing a majority along with his nationalist coalition partners in parliament and forcing a second-round vote in the presidential race. A voting observation mission by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe said political participation was high and voters had a choice between two political alternatives, but the incumbent president and the ruling parties enjoyed an unjustified advantage, including through biased media coverage. The polls were held against a background of a cost-of-living crisis that saw inflation peak at 85% in October, and earthquakes in February that killed more than 50,000 people in the country. These factors buoyed opposition hopes of unseating a leader known as Reis, or chief, by supporters of the governing Justice and Development Party. Kılıçdaroğlu has promised to fix Turkey's faltering economy and restore democratic institutions compromised under Erdogan's rule. Erdogan, on the other hand, has been extolling the virtues of his long rule, campaigning on a platform of a stability, independent foreign policy, and continuing to bolster Turkey's defense industry. Recently, he raised the wage of government workers by 45% and lowered the retirement age. Taking place at the same time as the presidential race was the election of 600 parliamentary deputies. Although this was mostly lost amid the debate about Erdogan and Kılıçdaroğlu and whether either would gather more than 50% of the vote and thus avoid a second round. Turkey's election is widely considered to be the most important in the world this year, as a fight for the future of Turkish democracy and a possible shift in Turkey's influential role on the world stage. Parliamentary and presidential elections took place in Turkey on Sunday. In the 600-seat parliament, Erdogan's Justice and Development Party and its allies secured by far the most seats, 321, while the opposition won 213, and the 66 remaining seats went to a pro-Kurdish alliance. The elections are crucial to the future of Turkey's battered economy. Also, the vote had been presented as a last chance to stop Erdogan from turning the country into a full-blown autocracy. From 2003, Erdogan served three terms as prime minister. In 2014, when he was barred from running again, Erdogan stood for the largely ceremonial role of president. In 2016, he survived a coup, but that only strengthened his grip and consolidated his political standing in the country. A year later, he won a referendum that gave him sweeping presidential powers. While Erdogan's grip on the levers of power has brought Turkey close to autocracy, he has made serious economic missteps recently. He has increased his control of the theoretically independent central bank and steadfastly refused to increase interest rates despite soaring inflation. Turkish people are far poorer and more uncertain of their future as a result. The government response to the devastating recent earthquake was widely viewed as inadequate. In February, Erdogan made the tone-deaf comment that whatever happens, happens. This is part of fate's plan. However, he has outperformed expectations and appears to be further ahead than was previously predicted. Kılıçdaroğlu, a former accountant and bureaucrat and the longtime head of the Republican People's Party, was not a universally popular choice among the opposition to a stand. A social democrat, Kılıçdaroğlu is at the head of a coalition that includes nationalists who are only supporting him because of their desperation to unseat Erdogan. He has promised to stand down after a single term after instituting more conventional economic policies and restoring full parliamentary democracy. CHP leader Kılıçdaroğlu's six-party nation alliance has pledged to dismantle an executive presidential system narrowly voted in by a 2017 referendum. The opposition alliance also promised to restore the independence of the judiciary and the central bank and to reverse crackdowns on free speech and dissent under Erdogan. Turkey's elections had been billed as the most consequential since its first fair multi-party polls in 1950, boiling down to a choice between five more years of Erdogan, Turkey's most electorally successful politician, or a new direction under an old party that has reinvented itself in recent years.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulema Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashimi Nejad. Please stay tuned. The salat of many people is null and void without themselves being aware of. Even we know some people who attend Hajj pilgrimage, but they don't know how to pray or what is the correct way of doing salat. This is a shame for people who go to holy places and still are unaware of the meaning of salat. Some people are doing their salat for 50 years and they do not go to the imam of the mosque to correct their salat recitation. This is absolutely wrong. The salat and wudu of many people are invalid without themselves knowing it. Even sometimes, the ghusl that some people do is wrong. If you are called a Muslim, you must do your salat, ghusl, and wuzu in the correct way. Therefore, if you don't know how to do it, refer to an alim of Islam and get consultation from him in this regard. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashim Nejad. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we look at a trending news story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we break it down from a Muslim perspective. A spat of Islamophobic attacks in the UK's second largest city, Birmingham, has put the spotlight once again on anti-Muslim racism in Britain. Official statistics show that Muslims are the most targeted group in this country, with nearly 3,500 hate crimes perpetrated against Muslims in England and Wales last year. So on today's show, we're going to ask why Islamophobia is reaching epidemic proportions and what can be done about it.
On the 29th of March, around 11 p.m., an elderly Muslim man walking home from his local masjid was viciously attacked by three men. The unprovoked assault left the 73-year-old victim hospitalized with a broken hand and multiple cuts to the face. The incident is just the latest example of an all-too-common event in Britain, Islamophobic hate crimes. The UK has a severe problem with anti-Muslim discrimination. Unchecked political rhetoric, combined with hostile media coverage, has created fear and mistrust. The seeds which breed hatred of the close to 4 million Muslims living in England. Right-wing terrorism poses a constant threat, with a far-right teenager found guilty of planning to murder Muslims at two mosques in England in March 2023. Unfortunately, some terrorists have been more successful, as was the case with Mohammed Salim, who was murdered in cold blood by Ukrainian neo-Nazi Pavlo Lapshin in April 2013. Another example was a terror attack near Finsbury Park Mosque in London, 2017. Islamophobe Darren Osborne drove a van into pedestrians, killing Makram Ali, again during the Islamic Holy Month. Despite these horrific murders, the UK government remains unwilling to find a working definition of Islamophobia. Critics suspect it's due to fear many of its party members would be found guilty of anti-Muslim prejudice.
Well, joining us today to talk about Islamophobia in the UK and elsewhere, we have Omar Kazmi, who is an anti-imperialist political activist who's recently finished a master's degree in human rights law. He previously worked on Jeremy Corbyn's 2016 leadership campaign and later worked in the UK Parliament. And Farah Kutena, originally from and raised in Al-Quds, from one of the last Palestinian families in the Old City. She is also the founder of Key 48, a campaign calling for the immediate right of return of all Palestinian refugees and a referendum amongst the global Palestinian community on the future of Palestine. Welcome to the show, both of you. Farah, let me come straight to you because you've been able to join me in the studio, which I appreciate. Just tell me, why are we seeing so much anti-Muslim hatred? And not only that, but it's boiling over to a proportion where people feel that it's okay to physically assault innocent Muslims in the street. Why is it getting that bad?
It's a culmination of multiple reasons. I think one of those reasons would be kind of the way in which Muslims have been depicted for the past few decades in TV series, in movies, in Hollywood, which we know has links to the CIA, kind of going along with any kind of US foreign policy that's fitting at the time. And then also we have within that culmination is British government policies, kind of prevent and other Islamophobic policies, and also kind of the attitudes of British governments at the time. You know, we know there's a rampant Islamophobia within the Conservative Party. We've had a Prime Minister, like, for example, Boris Johnson, who was extremely Islamophobic, never even really apologised, you know, let alone actually was held accountable for the Islamophobic remarks he made. And we know that there was a direct impact by those remarks. We know that his remark referring to Muslim women as letterboxes, as burglars, we know that the, you know, Islamophobic attacks on Muslim women increased by over 300% just as a direct result of that single comment he made. So it's a culmination of many factors.
Omar, you're joining us over Skype, and again, welcome to the show. Just tell me, in your opinion, who's more to blame for this atmosphere of hostility towards Muslims? Do you think that it's just politicians who are to blame, or perhaps the media has a major role in causing this problem?
Well, I think it's definitely both. I mean, the British media, which of course includes print, broadcast and radio, has played and continues to play a very, very large role in stoking Islamophobia. And I think this is a very important question because the media, by and large, is an extension of the British state. So I think there's not really that clear-cut divorce between politicians and the British media. They kind of work in tandem with each other, particularly the government of the day. And the British state, of course, has been a pioneer of 21st century Islamophobia across the globe, particularly in the post 9/11 period. There's almost no media outlet in Britain that is not, at least doctrinally, an extension